Warning. The following podcast may contain levels of sarcasm so high, even the hosts can't tell if they're joking or not. Listener discretion is advised. Just kidding, don't use discretion. We need to at least make it to episode number 3. You will be fine. Probably. This is the Non Sequitur Show. With your hosts, Kyle Curtis and Steve McRae.
Hey, we're back. We made it to 2 episodes. That's a good sign, right? Welcome to Non Sequitur. I'm one of your hosts, Kyle Curtis, joined by the other host, Steve McRae. And tonight we've got an exciting podcast for you guys. Tonight we're going to be diving into the processes behind stand-up comedy. There's more to what you just see than a person on a stage telling jokes. A lot of work goes into turning an idea into a laugh, and we're going to kind of jump into that. To help us with that, we have 2 very special guests tonight. We have Tony Deo and Steve Lesser. Now, first up is Tony Deo, and he is most notably known for his sharp, quick material and his near-perfect comedic timing. New York City's Village Voice calls him one of the tightest joke writers in the business. In 2013, he made his late-night television debut on Conan. Within a year, he had added appearances on CBS's The Late Late Show with Craig Ferguson, AXS's TV Gotham Comedy Live, and Comics Unleashed with Byron Allen. His latest album, Comedy Road Trip, landed him on the Billboard magazine comedy charts, and it debuted as the number one selling stand-up album on iTunes. With over 50 stand-up clips available, he has steadily become one of the most prolific comedians on YouTube. Now, Tony, let's stop it right there, because speaking of YouTube, I believe you have some advice for people who are thinking about maybe putting some videos up on YouTube and the comments they leave behind. Let's listen.
Tony himself will explain right now.
But I will tell you the story. When I take Conan, it was a dream come true. Ever since I was a kid in high school, watching comedians on The Tonight Show, all I wanted to do in life was be a stand-up comic and tell jokes on late-night TV. Conan gave me my chance. The show went great. They took my segment. They put it on YouTube. And I was really proud of what I had accomplished until I started reading YouTube comments. I did not realize it. There are people that write awful things about YouTube videos as a hobby. It's just what they do for fun. They're like, well, I got 15 minutes to kill. Let me go shit on someone's dreams. I didn't know that. I wasn't warned. They wrote things like, this guy sucks. I didn't laugh once. One guy, all he wrote was, boo, bitch. He only used 2 words and somehow managed to insult me twice. Two separate insults. Masterful use of the English language. I read all the comments, though. It ruined 3.5 days of my life. I couldn't get over it. What finally sort of pulled me out of my depression is I realized some of these morons that write these awful things, their YouTube screen name is either their exact name or something very easy to figure out. Like one dummy. His YouTube screen name was J. DeBaron Violin. All right, I'm going to take a wild guess. I bet the J is his first initial. I bet DeBaron is his last name. And I bet playing the violin is something he likes to do. Let me just crank up the Google machine. Take a look-see. Well, what do you know? His name is Jonathan DeBaron. He is indeed a violin player. And he has posted some of his own videos on YouTube. Oh, Jonathan. Now, here's what Jonathan knows about me. I'm a comedian. Here's what he does not know. I am shallow, petty, vindictive. And because I don't have to spend 6 hours a day practicing the violin, I got a lot of time on my hands. I created 34 separate YouTube accounts. Yep. Just to crush his little violin playing fantasy, and man, did it feel good. In fact, it felt so good, I recommend all you go home tonight, find his YouTube page, and give it a whirl. And just in case you're wondering, no, I did not change his name to protect his identity. DeBaron is spelled D-E-B-A-R-O-N. You guys have been great. Thank you so much.
That is a true story. I had just done Conan, and it was the greatest thing I'd done in my career. Mm-hmm. And I made the mistake of reading comments on YouTube videos.
Never read comments.
Yes.
No, but yeah, I learned my lesson that day. But it was just so depressing to me. And the great thing is, out of like emotional things like that, a lot of decent comedy can come out of it. And it made me sad and then angry, and then I wrote a joke, and it ended up being a great joke.
It, do you know if anyone from the audience took your advice and went and added their own comedy?
Yeah, so for about a year after I started doing that joke, people would come up to me after the show and ask me the guy's name, and they would write it down, and they would go to his YouTube page and just trash the guy. And he ended up pulling down all of his videos, which I considered a giant success.
Yes, and, I would say.
It's funny, there's a comedian friend of mine who's a very nice guy, and he asked me, he's like, "Don't you feel bad about that?" I was like, "What? No." Like, it didn't even occur to me that I should feel bad about that.
People can be brutal, can't they? I mean, comments especially. I do read all my comments, by the way. And most of them are very positive, and I love that. But when you get that one, it's like, even if it's like you get 100 comments that are great, you get that one person who's not happy, you're like, "What did I do wrong?"
Yeah, it's the one that'll stick with you.
It's weird because you don't even know the person, you know, but it still like affects you. You walk around all day going, "Why?"
They talk to you like they do. They like you're like you've known them for years, like you're supposed to remember thousands of people, which is fine. I try to memorize as many people as I can, but yeah, it's a little disconcerting when people are like leaving negative feedback, even if it's valid. It still kind of stings a little bit, but
I love the ones more when they're trying to give you advice, and you're like, "I just did late night television. You have no advice."
During a stand-up show, like live, you've got your set in your head. You know what you want to say. You know how to deliver it. The timing's on. How derailing is it when you're up there and you have that mindset that somebody shouts something out from the crowd, good or bad?
It's it can be derailing, especially for a comedian like myself who. My jokes are they're written very purposefully. I know exactly every word I'm going to say. So if someone interrupts you, it can throw off the joke. And what I normally do, number one, I'm not the type of comedian that gets heckled very often. I don't talk about controversial subjects. And so people generally don't feel the need to interrupt me. But some people are just, you know, excited or want to mention or whatever, and they will talk to you. And a lot of times you just kind of make a judgment call of whether you can go back into the joke and finish it, or if they interrupt it at a weird time and you're like, "Well, I'll just continue on." But I rarely, I honestly can't remember the last time I was heckled angrily by someone. It just doesn't really happen that often.
That's great.
Do most places put the kibosh on that when they see that happening? Do they all step in and or they let the comedian do take care of the heckler?
Right. Yeah. I mean, and there's some comedians that want it to happen. They would prefer to, you know, have that sort of interaction with someone. I'm not that way, but it happens so rarely it doesn't even occur to me to ask the comedy club to do anything about it.
Yeah.
But they will, especially if they see that it's bothering somebody or whatever, they'll take someone out.
One of the things most comedians dream about is actually being on TV. And you got to experience that. What was that like?
It was amazing. It's will probably, I have a hard time imagining something in my career being as impactful as that was. Because it elevates you from one level to another level as a comedian. And I got it by submitting a YouTube clip, oddly enough, in, you know, the 2000 and odds or whatever we call this decade we're in.
Yeah.
You know, you had to go through an agent, and an agent had to submit for you, and it's not that way anymore. I had an email address of the guy that booked comedians, and I sent him a YouTube clip, and he said, I like this joke and this joke and this joke and this joke. He kind of went through the whole set and told me which ones he liked. He said, can you tape those in a row, like all of those just as a set by itself? And so I went down to Philly, to a club that I happen to know the owner, and they're very nice, and it's an amazing comedy club, and they let me go up on a Friday night and tape just that set. And the early show on Friday, I bombed that set, and the late show was
really
amazing. And, yeah. So I sent that tape to him, and he said, that's the set. I'll have you on by September. And within 3 months of me submitting the first YouTube clip, it was only 3 months from that time until I stepped out on the stage. It went incredibly easily. It was very easy. The whole process was so easy, and so easy that I didn't actually believe it. I didn't tell anyone I was going to be on the show until it was on their website.
What?
Yeah, because I had friends that went through the process with Letterman, and it was a year-long process. They transcribed their act. They told them, take out this word, take out this word. They down to every comma, they nitpicked.
Really?
And yeah, and the Conan show was so easy. I'm like, am I being punked? Like,
they're just saying, could be funny, right? All they did.
Yeah, and when it finally showed up on Conan's website, that's when I told people I was going to be on the show.
Now, during this process, did they try to censor any of your material or tell you which jokes they thought would work and which ones they thought wouldn't?
Not at all. They just picked the jokes they liked, and they said, do these.
Oh, that's
and
great.
They were even so laid back enough to say, you know, if something happens, you know, in the moment on television and you feel like you need to address it, feel free. Which, that was mind-blowing to me, that they were giving me a little leeway on television.
In my opinion, the only negative attribute of a joke is that it loses its effectiveness after the first time you tell it. Did you have to do more than one take?
No.
In that show? Okay, that's good.
Yeah, as far as I know, I don't know. I've heard of one instance on the Johnny Carson show that they did two takes for the comedian.
That would be awful.
Because he walked out. But he walked out and he didn't remember his lines. And they started over for him.
Yeah.
And, but yeah, everyone I've ever talked to, you only get one shot at it. But the audience was fantastic.
I remember how nervous I used to get before open mic nights. I can imagine how that would be before a TV show. I would probably forget my lines too.
I don't think you would, because it's such a big moment. You over-prepare for it.
It's a huge moment.
Yeah, and you know, the weeks leading up to it, I just went out and ran that set as many times as I could.
Yeah.
So you've done it enough, and you don't get thrown into that situation when you're not ready for it. Very rarely does that happen.
Now let's talk about you. Your style is very unique, and I think every comedian has the thing that they're known for. You know, Lewis Black is known for being angry. Larry the Cable Guy is known for that. Get her done. You, however, are known, at least to me anyway, for something a little bit more interesting. You always wear a suit on stage. Always. Why always a suit?
That is a good question. And it started, I went on the road with Caroline Ray for some theater shows. And the first time I did it, I wore what I was wearing at the time, which was jeans and a button-down T-shirt with the sleeves rolled up just so. I call it the comedian uniform. Because it's what every
yes,
comedian wears.
Absolutely.
And we got to this theater, and she was dressed very nicely. And I don't know why it took me until being at the theater, you know, to realize this might be a situation where I should dress up. So I felt like a dum-dum. And so the next time she took me out on the road, I was like, oh, I'll just, you know, use the money I'm getting paid. I'll buy a suit and then I'll be appropriately dressed. And I wore it and I felt so comfortable in it. And I felt like it fits my personality. It fits my persona. It fits my act. Everything about it works with the type of stand-up comedian I am. So I just decided that that's the way it was going to be. And I love it. When I run around in New York City doing spots, I don't wear the suit. And I'm actually uncomfortable when I don't.
Well, wearing a suit makes you feel better. I mean, I was in sales for many years. And when you wear a suit, you have a lot more confidence than
yeah.
wearing some kind of like dress down stuff. Yeah. That's true.
Yeah, it's like my Superman outfit.
I think each individual comedian has their own unique process they go to take a joke from just an idea they had and turn it into laughter. Take us through your process and how you turn just ideas into something that can actually make people laugh.
Well, I'm as I mentioned, I'm a very written comedian. So I spend, you know, there's a lot of guys that kind of work it out on stage, and I'm not good at that. And I don't know if it's just because I'm not on stage, you know, five times a night, every single night of the year. Maybe I would be better at that, but I'm a guy that writes. So I'll have an idea. And the first thing I do is I just sort of jot it down in a little tiny notebook that I always carry with me. And every day I sit down and try to spend about an hour writing. Whether it's on a new joke or trying to fix a joke that I think should be better, or, you know, trying to make an older joke longer and expand on it. But I'll just sit down and I kind of write out like the first thing that occurs to me, and then I'll let it sit for a couple of days, and then I'll go back to it and I'll see if I still think that's the funny angle on it. And if I still think that works, then I'll try it, you know, somewhere in the city. You know, you go up and do 8 or 10 minute spots in the city. And on a lot of those shows, they're the type of show where you can try new material. No one feels like they paid a bunch of money and you got to be on your A game and you got to be just hitting home runs every joke. So on shows like that, you got to get a lot of leeway. And so I will try a bunch of things I've written, and a lot of guys record, and I should record, but I'm pretty good about remembering what the reaction was to each, you know, punchline or what I thought should be funny. And I think that sort of comes from being such a written comic that I know all the words and I know where I think they're supposed to laugh. And you know, it hits me when they don't laugh. So I have a pretty good memory for that. And I'll come off stage and I'll make a few notes and then kind of go back to the drawing board. And either it worked or it didn't. Or if it worked, great. Can I make this part of something else I'm doing, or can I make it longer? And that's kind of my process. It's definitely a building it brick by brick sort of process.
Do you have a joke that you really liked and you were all about, it hasn't ever worked?
Yes, I've probably got 1,000 of those.
Do you keep trying them?
What I will do, because I've been meticulous about keeping everything I've ever written. I keep it in, I haven't used Evernote. And I have a notebook in Evernote that has every joke I've ever written. And I will go back every once in a while and look through it. Because what happens is you put it, you know, if I wrote it down once and I thought it was funny, there's probably something funny about it. But either I didn't hit the right angle on it, or I wasn't a good enough comedian at the time to make it work. I've found that many times. I'll go way, way back in my notebooks and things I wrote when I was very young. And I couldn't make it work then, but I was not a very good comedian then. And I'll see the idea. I'm like, that's still funny to me. And I'll work it on it again. And a lot of times I'll scrap whatever I wrote because it clearly didn't work the first time. Mm-hmm. And try to rewrite it from the beginning and see if I can get to the idea in a better way.
Is that more because as you get better, you learn more about timing and inflection?
Yeah.
Performance, that kind of thing. Is that why you think the jokes initially may not have been
exactly
as good as it would now?
Right. For me, performance was the big thing for me. When I've known Kyle since I started comedy, and I'm sure he remembers When I first started, the only thing I had were jokes. I had no performance ability whatsoever.
Well, I disagree. Because, and we'll talk about why you had some performance here in just a second, but you definitely had a side to you that was not shy at all.
Maybe. My stand-up persona had no performing ability. And so I definitely lived or died on whether the joke was good or not. And then over time, I learned to be more comfortable as a comedian. And I still wouldn't say I'm a great performer, but I do what I do fairly well.
Well, I'm not a comedian, but I can tell you I've had performance issues, so I understand where you're coming from.
Who would you say are your biggest influences in comedy?
Oh, man, there's so many of them. When I first started, I thought Brian Regan was amazing. And Seinfeld I watched religiously. Over time, there's been a lot of guys. Bill Burr right now, I think, is one of the greatest comedians. Michael Che's last special was amazing. I get inspired by just guys I know in New York City that are, Ryan Hamilton is an amazing comedian. Every time I watch that guy, I'm like, I wish I'd written every single joke he tells. I'm like, man, why didn't I think of that?
All right. Joining us now is Steve Lesser, who for over 20 years has been pleasing crowds with a blended comedic style that draws on a lifetime of mistakes and embarrassment. And he has an unusual take on the world. Steve is the co-founder of the Idiot Box Comedy Club in Greensboro, North Carolina, where he regularly performs stand-up, improv, as well as sketch, and in addition to coaching other comedians. He is also a successful producer, with producing credits, including the North Carolina Comedy Festival and the Ultimate Comic Challenge, which is now in its 10th year. UCCX. Steve, welcome to Non Sequitur. Well, out of all of those job descriptions, let's start out with comedy club owner. You own the Idiot Box Comedy Club in Greensboro, North Carolina. Fantastic club. What are the things that you look for in booking a comedian?
That might be a unique answer for the Idiot Box because our business model is unique. So I started it with my wife, Jenny Stencil. She's the more famous of the two of us, but we ended up doing this out of a love for doing comedy. Started as an improv comedy club, turned into a stand-up improv and sketch place. And honestly, we do all sorts of weird things at the club that anything that's funny goes on. So when somebody comes to us and says it's a local regional person and they've, especially if they've been supporting the club and supporting the comedy community, we'll support them in putting up a show or, we've had comics put on game shows. We've had roast battles. We do all sorts of things. But, when it's a national act or somebody sends up a video, we're looking for creativity. We're looking for stage presence. We're just looking for likability, honestly. Mm-hmm. And I imagine mm-hmm. any comedy club is looking for likability. If the audience is going to like them, we put them up. And yeah. we love to support that sort of thing.
Yeah.
We don't, it's not just a blank check where anybody can come in off the street. We certainly do try to have a minimum set of standards. But what I think we've helped build, we can't take full credit for, but across North Carolina from Wilmington to Asheville to Charlotte, and even into Virginia where people will come regularly and perform and I'm honored when these folks are calling the Idiot Box their house club. But we have a quite the community of comics that I would call on for any showcase show. Some of them I would trust for a real hot 5 minutes and some 30 and lots in between, a lot on the newer side. But that's how a comedy community gets created, I think.
Now, Tony and Steve, do you guys know each other? Have you worked together? I know all of us being in kind of the same area, it would kind of be hard to believe that you guys haven't crossed paths yet.
think we met once. Is that correct, Steve?
That is correct.
Yeah. I remember going to the Idiot Box sometime right before I left North Carolina. And I believe you were still just an improv club at the time.
Yeah.
But I was trying to make a tape for a late night TV submission. And I don't think the Funny Bone was around anymore, and I needed a place. And I was like, hey, can I just – I know you guys don't do stand-up, but is there any way I could come in and do, like, 10 minutes? And you guys were nice, and you let me come in and do it, and it was fantastic.
Small world, I tell you. It's crazy how everyone's kind of connected like that.
Yeah. I love that like where I started still has a comedy club, because it kind of broke my heart when the Funny Bone closed.
Yeah.
And I love that there's a place now in Greensboro where comedy still happens.
Now, Steve, did you guys recently move from downtown?
Yes, we moved from downtown to Midtown. They're trying to brand a Midtown in Greensboro.
Oh, nice.
But the
what does that mean?
And what we have, I don't know. Especially in the context of a big metropolis like Greensboro.
Yeah.
But it's on the outskirts of downtown, and the difference for us is that we have a parking lot, and audience likes parking lots. So
yeah.
Since we've moved, we've had people come out to it more regularly, and crowds have been better. But our space is actually an ideal place for comedy now. It doesn't sound good on paper. It's in the basement of a coffee shop, right? So you go into a coffee shop and you go down.
That sounds perfect to me.
I was going
to
say, yeah. That sounds like you're...
Tony, you know it sounds perfect because you've done that. It feels like a New York club to me. It's this small black box theater. We seat like 68 when we sell out, and when we had Doug Stanhope, we moved upstairs and we had it in the coffee house and converted the coffee house into a club as best we could. But I love that new space. So Midtown, downtown, that room is really a good room for comedy.
Doug Stanhope. I love Doug Stanhope.
That show was crazy. It probably broke the record for for our sellout, right? So we've had shows sell out before, of course, but I think his show was up for 24, 48 hours at the most before it sold out of that bigger space, and it was pretty incredible. That show also had Doug come into the coffee house and then turn right around because he's like, I'm not doing a show in a coffee house.
Now that sounds like Doug Stanhope.
I paid my dues. But he was great. He was great. We converted the coffee house into the club. He came in early, and then we had the stage set up and the chairs set up, and he was all good. It was a great show.
Earlier, you mentioned your famous half, as you put it, Jenny Stenzel. I was looking the other day on YouTube, and she has 15 million views on one of her videos.
It's insane. She was kind of headhunted to a certain extent out of the comedy club, being both pretty and funny, and said, let's put you on the news. And they didn't want her for news. They wanted her for infotainment.
Of course.
They wanted to put the silly story in front of her and have her do her crazy stuff. And it worked out well for them. And they have videos like 15 million and I think that's probably one of her bigger videos, but she's got dozens of videos that have a million plus.
So for those of you out there that don't know Steve's wife, her name is Jenny Stenzel, and she is on the local news morning show. She does traffic reports and comic relief whenever it's needed. But this video I'm about to play, she has 15 million views. 15 million. So here's Jenny Stenzel in traffic rap.
Jenny has traffic.
All right, I'm all nervous, but here's my rap.
All right, you're gonna have a good, good drive today. There ain't no problems on the major roadways. Looking, looking at Country Club, things will look pretty good like Robin Hood. Now I'm moving across the triad, yo. It ain't too bad, no, 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 no. Now things look nice on 68, and I know you ain't gonna be late. So that was your traffic wrap today. Man, let's get some weather from my weather girl, Austin Cavanaugh. Come on, give us a weather, boy. Give it to us. Word.
Oh, there you go. Oh boy, Jenny, it's weather guy, by the way. That is something.
That one was one of the, you know, that's probably going back a decade. And,
yeah.
You know, that's when, you know, people didn't even know what a viral video was. They just, it just went viral and they're like, all right. But their VH1 did a show that year on, you know, top 10 viral videos, and she was on there. It was kind of cool.
What?
Just watching VH1 and her rap comes up.
Oh.
Now, the funny thing about that video, as popular as it is on YouTube, she hates it because, especially at the time, we were doing a lot in our improv shows. We do a lot of improvised raps, and she was very good. I am not, but she was very good. And so but that's one of her worst raps, you know, so she's really bothered by the fact that, you know, it doesn't meet her standards.
Oh, that's crazy. The Idiot Box, the thing that I love about the Idiot Box personally is, like you said, it's a place that you can go and it's not one steady concept. You know, you do improv, you do stand-up. You've got some big things coming up. I know the Ultimate Comic and then the Comedy Festival. Why don't you kind of talk us through, number one, how you got involved with doing the Comedy Festival, and then let's talk about some of the acts that you have coming.
Sure. So I guess time-wise, the first thing that's coming up is the Ultimate Comic Challenge, which is a stand-up comedy competition. We've done it for 10 years now, so this is our 10th annual, so UCCX. And,
oh, man, that makes me feel old.
Yeah, me too. just waking up in the morning makes me feel old.
That's right.
The thing that I love about the UCC is that it really is meant to highlight the local and regional comics. This year we had 95 comics enter it, and
wow.
The six finalists are set to go up on stage on the 20th. So this Saturday,
back in 2008, I remember when I did it, you had, I think, 64 comics even that first year that you.
Yeah, and here's the thing. I mean, there was comics that deserved to be up there at the time, and then there was people that had never done comedy that had just signed up for the competition because
yeah. So
they're like, oh, we're gonna win. But this year, you know, the field of 95, they're all comics that have their chops under them. It was actually a very impressive field, and you know, I think that just proves the concept of, and it's not just the Idiot Box, it's clubs like Dead Crow, and it's clubs like Good Nights, you know, in Charlotte as well, the community there. I think there's a lot of efforts building up the North Carolina comedy scene in it, and I think that's showing in these kind of big events. So, like, and then about 6 years ago, we moved the finals to a theater. So, the finalists now have this amazing experience of doing a theater show. Last year, we had 800 people at that show. And
wow.
If you go and do.
Can I sign up?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's kind of the cool thing about the Idiot Box. We're not so sold on our location. So, we right size for the show. We're doing stuff at lots of different venues. So, and that's going to come into more to play for the festival kind of discussion. But, I mean, this experience is such an amazing experience. The crowds have been great. And when 800 people laugh at you at the same time for something you intended them to laugh at, it's just incredible. It is just incredible. Some of my best experiences doing stand-up has been, you know, on that stage on that night. It's unbelievable. So very much looking forward to that.
I know you probably can't answer this question, but do you have any indication of who's going to win this year?
No, I really don't. And I think that, again, is just, you know, just speaks to the quality of the people in it. Mm-hmm. You know, like the first year, you know, I could look at the field and say, these are the people that deserve to be in the finals. And, you know, here's a couple that I think are going to win. And I could do that on day one. And now with a 95, once we got to the semifinals and we had 24 comics, I was like, any one of these people, and these men or women could win. It was really incredible. It more matters on who has that great night. So you have that great night and you happen to pop a little bit more, you punch above your weight class, and like any one of these comics can win. And what's neat is they all have, you know, it's six different comics with six different styles and voices. It's awesome.
Before we go into the festival discussion, real quick, kind of tell us about what the UCC is, when the finals are actually going to be, what time, and then if somebody's interested and they're in the North Carolina area and they want to maybe try out next year, give them the rundown on how they can get involved.
Sure. So this year's show is January 20th. It's Saturday night, 8:30 p.m. You can buy tickets at the Carolina Theater box office. So you can go onto their website, which is carolinatheater.com. And theater is spelled the more the fancier way, with the R-E, not E-R. and so Carolina Theater Greensboro, you'll find the link and you can buy tickets. You can even pick them up at the door because it's an 1,100-seat theater. And, you know, while I would love to sell that out, you know, we'll be a couple hundred shy. So there'll be room that night. You can actually just show up at the theater and buy your tickets and head on in for some laughs.
That's amazing.
And then if you want to sign up, and support, you know, next year, just on the Idiot Box website is the best way to kind of find out the information about when we start this, when you can start to sign up for that. Same thing for, you know, submissions for the festival. All that stuff ends up on our Facebook page and our website as well, which is ibxcomedy.com.
And Tony, while we're doing web addresses, where can people go to see more of you? Do you have any albums that you're selling? Where can they find those? And what's coming up?
Let's see. I do have a website, tonydeo.com, and that's D-E-Y-O. And from there, you can get to my YouTube page, and I have tons of videos and things there. I've worked very hard the last couple of years getting that to sort of be a one-stop shop for me. And I do have a couple albums. My newest one I'm really proud of. It was called Comedy Road Trip, 20 Jokes in 20 Cities. And I recorded it all over the country. Each track is from a different comedy club or theater and even a tiny little coffee shop in Charlottesville, Virginia. And I thought it was a cool way to do an album so that people could kind of hear that comedians don't do the same thing or venue every night. It varies wildly. And so I was really happy with how that album came out. And the next thing big, I taped my first special in September, and it should be out in, I think, in February. It's on not the widest serving platform. It's not on Netflix or HBO or anything, but it's through a service called VidAngel. So anyone who uses VidAngel will be able to see that.
You've got a really, really, really awesome project coming up next month, the North Carolina Comedy Festival. How did you get involved with that, and what kind of talent are you bringing to North Carolina?
For some time, we've been wanting to do a festival, started to try to figure out how to create a niche festival at first, and then the stars aligned, and we had the opportunity to bring what we're calling the North Carolina Comedy Festival into the Triad, and so we opened up submissions, had hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of submissions out of that. picked about 130 comedians as well as sketch groups and improv groups. So we have about 250 comedians coming in that week.
Wow.
It's February 19th through the 24th. And then it's not just, we watched hours and hours and hours, in fact, days of submission videos, which is...
How was that for your psyche?
I learned what not to do in a submission video. I do know that. For anybody listening, don't start with 15 seconds, if that, of how are you guys doing tonight. That's the wrong thing to do.
That's the goal. That and you. I learned two rules when I first. Long time ago when I did stand up, and that is never ask how an audience is doing and never ask a comedian to tell a joke. You know, at the end of the night, you have people come up to you and they're like, hey, tell me something funny.
I usually just come back with, I find out what they do and I'm like, oh yeah, well, write me a premium, Mr. Insurance Guy. You know, I just turn that around. That's impossible to avoid. For a short period, I was, the other thing that you get as a comedian is people telling you jokes to, you can use this in your act. Yeah. And for a short time, I was actually doing that. I'd find out their name and I'd say, here's the name and the city.
That's brilliant.
And I'd be like, yeah, but it's a little meaner than I intended it to be. I thought it was going to just be funny. And so I felt a little guilty because I was like, now you can actually go find this person and so you can troll them or something. I don't know.
Did you make a YouTube series out of it?
I should have.
Definitely.
Just a series of jokes that people told me to tell. Yeah. That would actually make a great YouTube series. That would definitely be there. That's right. I wonder what the commenters would be on those jokes.
That's excellent.
We're merely the delivery person. You can't actually blame us for the writing of those.
It's foolproof.
They would find a way.
That's true. They would find a way.
That's true.
Yeah. So I guess the thing I wanted to say about the festival that as lovely and amazing as it is to have 250 comedians coming to it, we went out and got some real amazing headliners and we try to have a good group that would, you know, widely represent the tastes for the area. And so we have Sashir Zameda,
awesome,
coming in as one of our headliners, which, her SNL credit, I thought was going to be really appealing to the people that are participating because she ticks the box for stand up and sketch and improv all at the same time, which is kind of fantastic. And then Eddie Pepitone and Todd Glass and Ms. Pat, and then Mo Alexander and Eddie Brill. So we have a bunch of great talent that are going to headline each night of that week. And then on top of the stand-ups that I just mentioned, we have an improv group from Second City coming back. It's a two-woman show that from a couple women that used to perform with us regularly back when you were hanging out at the Idiot Box, Sejal Joshi and Julie Marciano. They're coming back from Chicago where they're on the main stage of Second City.
Julie?
Doing their show. Yeah. You remember Julie?
Oh, absolutely. I remember Julie.
Yeah.
Julie Will.
Yeah, so their group is Mr. Chrysler, which is awesome. And then you probably remember AJ Schrader. He's going to be he's in a nationally touring sketch group called the Don't We Boys with Joe Anderson and Sonny Pandit, and then AJ Schrader, of course.
I remember him, but I didn't recognize him when the long hair and the beard cut off. I remember him posting.
That's right. He went from his homeless look to a cleaned up look, now he's he's an amazing creative guy.
Absolutely.
He makes his living doing sketch comedy, and I gotta admit, I'm jealous. How awesome is that?
He was I remember the what was the puppet's name? Do you remember that the bit he used to do?
Anthony Janum. was the name of the puppet. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, he did a bunch of stand up with a puppet. He was not doing ventriloquism. He just, the stage persona was this puppet.
It was brilliant.
Because he was doing the UCC every year. He was part of the Ultimate Comic Challenge.
He was.
He would always make a rule that he wouldn't tell the same jokes twice. It was very impressive. He was writing a fresh new set each week and delivering it through a puppet. It was pretty amazing.
Yeah.
It was. And then the next year, he went in a completely different direction. He made it through the UCC and won that year without saying a word. He did all of his stand-up through PowerPoint, and it was pretty impressive.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, he does these one-man, sketch shows at festivals. Uh-huh. And, he was actually kind of crafting that at the Idiot Box through that kind of multimedia presentation with music and slides and delivering those jokes. And he's up there, as just like his presence on stage is just one visual component of the joke. It's kind of wild.
So you're having like almost a reunion of sorts too during the festival.
Yeah. Well, that's the wonderful, you mentioned it's a small world thing. And so we're getting to, we have a pretty wide network at this point. We're not a club that's doing, a headliner every weekend, Thursday through Sunday, but we do get headliners that come through and, they're coming back and they're helping spread the word, and the festival is a great place for that to happen. It's an incredible thing. Very much looking forward to it.
I know it's getting kind of close for Tony, and you're doing a show tonight. Tony, where are you at tonight, by the way?
I'm in Hershey, Pennsylvania tonight. I have a corporate gig.
Good to go?
Yeah.
You don't sound like a fan of the corporate gig.
They're not the most fun. they pay well. So at this point in my life with a little boy and a family, sometimes pay wins out over breaking even to go to Iowa.
Well,
they're kind of a crapshoot, I think, Tony. Yeah, don't
they
you
agree that,
like, because sometimes they're fantastic, and then sometimes they'd rather be chatting, and you're competing with just other noise in the room, and it can be very painful.
And sometimes you're just the wrong guy, which happened to me in December. I got hired to do a Christmas party for a logging company in West Virginia.
Whoa!
And,
wow!
And in my defense, they saw my videos. They saw me wearing my suit. They knew what they were getting.
Oh man, but, this is such a great visual.
Oh man, it was.
How much flannel?
It was mostly camouflage. The owner was wearing, and this is their holiday party. Their once a year get together. The owner was wearing shorts, and it was 20 degrees outside. And he was wearing a Three Stooges T-shirt that said "Sweetly."
Where can we find this on video?
Oh man, boy, I don't think it exists. But it's funny. My contract says that there has to be a sound system for me to perform with. And what they came up with was a small home karaoke machine.
Stop it. Stop it.
That I could only stand 4 feet away from because that's how long the cord was. And it had a little disco light that went around and around on top of it the whole time.
Oh, that sounds beautiful only after the fact.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I was getting ready to say there's situations that you get in where at the time it's horrible, but the story is so good later on that it's worth doing.
Right. Driving away, I'm like, this will be a good story tomorrow. Right now, it still hurts.
What kind of fresh. What kind of business is the one you're doing tonight?
Like, tonight, I think it's a teacher's convention, so a little more in my wheelhouse.
Oh, you're golden then. The school bus bit?
You know what? I don't do that anymore. That's a retired joke.
What?
I don't even quite remember it.
Well, I remember the one joke that sticks out of yours in my mind, and people can watch the video because I'm not even going to attempt to try to do it justice, but the no molesting. I still, to this day, I cannot read that on a sign the you know that hangs outside the door and not think of Tony Deo ever. So I guess it's, I guess it's good that I relate Tony Deo with molesting.
Yeah, thank you, Kyle.
Well, Tony, it has been a pleasure catching up and seeing all of the great things that you have going on. But we can't thank you enough for taking the time out to come on here and talk about your career. It couldn't be happening to a nicer guy.
Hey, thanks so much, Kyle. It was good seeing you again, Steve.
Yeah, take care, Tony.
Thank you for joining us, Tony.
Bye-bye.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, but don't go anywhere. We're coming back with more Steve Lesser to discuss the North Carolina Comedy Festival, as well as the psychology involved in stand-up comedy. So be sure to stick around. Non Sequitur will return in 60 seconds.
To nccomedyfestival.com because I might get of the 50 shows, I might have nights mixed up, that sort of thing. But that Monday night, Mo Alexander is it, that one is a, the headline show is a, is mixed. So that one, Mr. Chrysler is in that one. So is the Don't We Boys. Oh no, sorry. That's a different sketch group. That's Unstoppable Failure, which is another great name.
That is a great name.
It is indeed. So Unstoppable Failure, Mr. Chrysler and Mo Alexander is the Monday night headlining show. Tuesday night is Todd Glass. Sorry, Ms. Pat is Tuesday. Todd Glass is Wednesday. Eddie Pepitone is Thursday. Sashir is Friday. And then on Saturday, our headline show is again a mix of improv and sketch and stand up as well. So we actually are you know, doing a handful of like headline shows. All those headliner shows that I just mentioned, we're doing at the Star Theater, which is you know, a theater that was renovated by the Community Theater of Greensboro. And it's a, you know, kind of a fantastic 160 seat theater. And then we have shows also going on at the Idiot Box at the same time. And we have shows going on at the Crown, which is the upstairs at the Carolina Theater. That's on Wednesday and Thursday and Friday at the Crown. And Tuesday we have shows at High Point. So it's a lot to explain in a sentence or two. But the best way to do it is to go on to nccomedyfestival.com and look at the shows link and see what's going on. We're also one of our partners. So one of the great things about the festival is that we have a lot of community support, and in that community support, we have businesses stepping up and sponsoring the event. And one of the sponsors is Yes Weekly. They're going to be coming out with a festival guide, and so that guide will come out a week before the festival, and you'll be able to see all the shows, where they're playing, but based on that, you know, what night, and it'll say who's in it and where it is, and that sort of thing. But from our website, from the festival website, you can actually get to the all the links to buy the tickets and take care of that. And so you know, the more people that come out and support, the better and bigger this thing becomes for next year. So maybe it's not just a, you know, a week long thing. Maybe it grows to something even bigger and better.
So, Steve, when do you sleep?
I use my day job for that.
Yeah. There's an optimistic sarcasm about you, I think.
I like that. I like to be kind of a bit of a contradiction up there, because I think I try to be a smart comedian, but I highlight how stupid I am at the same time. And so you end up having this kind of strange persona up there that, you know, is certainly is, you know, I don't want people to think that I'm an idiot up there, but, you know, so I'm not trying to play an idiot, but I am trying to play the smartest guy in the room that's also just so clueless about certain things. And that I really do enjoy that kind of stage persona, that kind of, you know, naive look at the world, and still pointing out something that people didn't notice before. And I do love playing with that kind of that paradox, right? So when you say, you know, optimistic sarcasm, that's good, right? That's right in that wheelhouse of what I like to play with in that stage persona.
We kind of think in that direction, like with the sarcasm. I'm a really big fan of dry wit and sarcasm too. But did you know that every single day has its own day for something?
Oh, it's crazy. Yeah, I agree with you on that. That's a little insane.
Do you want to know what today's is?
I would love to know what today's is.
And I'm not even joking with you. Today is National Hot Buttered Rum Day.
See, that's the thing. They seem to be scraping the bottom of the barrel as far as National Whatever Day. And amazing as hot buttered rum sounds, there's probably like nine other things that it's also this other day.
Oh yeah.
And sometimes if you look at the things, I can't remember what day of the year it is, but there's a time where it's like National Women Week or something like that, and on that week that starts with National Dog Day, and when you go onto Facebook, everybody was like, hey, it's National Dog Day, and I'm like, what does it say about our society that women are getting
epic
second billing to the canine world?
Steve, what was the day before yesterday we were talking about? It was National Nothing Day, National
Nothing Day.
National
Scalpel, without a scalpel day.
Yeah, National. It was 4 days, but you had Freedom from or Freedom of Religion Day. You had Fig Newton Day. You had Without a Scalpel Day. But those three things were celebrated on Nothing Day, which by the definition on the website says is a day set aside for people to celebrate nothing going on.
There was quite a contradiction there.
I mean, it just blows my mind. I know that's random, but I wanted to see if there were other people out there that thought it was as ridiculous as I did.
Although I gotta say, I could get behind Nothing Day. You know,
yeah.
Anything that involves, you know, that plays to my strengths of procrastination, I think I can get behind.
I would agree.
That and like Cookie Day. You know, if I can support that in any way, I'm happy to.
Oh, there's a Cookie Day. Steve, I believe you have a couple questions that you wanted to ask as somebody who.
Yeah, as somebody who's not funny, yeah, I like to kind of ask a couple questions to kind of help.
I was trying to say that as nicely as I could.
Yeah, I know. You're getting it out there. You could say it. I'm not very funny. I get it. So my a couple questions I had is, you know, if you have a joke, because I used to write a little bit for like e-cards and some of the things kind of funny, but how do you know if a joke's funny? I mean, it's not like you could go to a mirror and just recite it like a speech, right? You need some kind of feedback. So what starts the process where you say to yourself, here, I think of this, I laugh, how do I know other people laugh to it?
That comes with experience. I think my process is actually not unlike Tony's. I'm also a writer. I will jot down in my phone onto Google Keep the funny idea and then go back and develop it. And I do develop some stuff on stage, but it takes me so much longer to develop it on stage. So I like to write, and through just performing, I think you have a sense of how to tell that joke, so you do get the reaction. And so I think. You know, I think a lot of comedians, when they're starting to write, they don't have that experience. I had the benefit of being in about 4,000 improv comedy shows before I actually took the stage and did my first open mic. And that actually, I think, went much better than I would have dreamed of, honestly. But I think I kind of took the stage and I had more experience about what is funny, what will work, what won't work. And while I was rough around some of the stand-up skills, and those have been honed over the years, I think I instinctually knew what was funny. And I think for me, it's a combination of what do I think is funny, as well as what can I confidently say to an audience without having that. Jenny, my wife, will refer to it as having it come out sideways. So I have a stage persona and a personality in real life that doesn't like to offend or you know, put anybody off. So if I, you know, if I'm using a word that I would use amongst a small knit group of friends, you know, even if it's just the F-bomb, and I'm in front of a full audience, I always have this like pause of like, I don't know if everybody's going to love this, right? So I need to do a combination of what I think will be generally acceptable by an audience and what I think is funny. And then those two things together usually work.
Okay, answer my next question. This one actually, I really like to know because I've been in similar situations with this. So I don't know if you drink, but I don't know if you like hot buttered rum, even though that's like the national day of hot buttered rum.
Oh, man.
Yeah, you know what? I'm going to have to celebrate that next year. I'm telling you right now. Got to tell me in advance and get some hot buttered rum. But what I want to know is if you're type of comedian where you do drink, is there like a line of demarcation where you know you drank too much and you start thinking to yourself that I'm only funny to myself and because nobody else is laughing? Is there like a fine line that you get? I mean, what's that threshold you get when you have like one drink, two drinks, and after that, then it starts diminishing? Or is there that optimal range?
I've actually, from stand-up perspective, I've always been, oddly enough, the drunkest I've ever been on stage was in Dublin, Ireland.
Oh, well, and if you're going to be any place.
Yeah.
And so, and it wasn't like a big theater show there. I got put on a bar show and just via Facebook and eventually guilted them into putting me on the show. So I was the sole American. And when I went there, I had already had some drinks at dinner. But at the same time, it's a bar show. And I wanted to support the venue. Like, I know what it is to run these things. And if people aren't buying drinks, you're not making money. So
I love how
I bought some drinks.
I love how you put that in there as supporting the venue.
So when you're a comedian, you know, that's part of your audience is the venue, the booker, the actual audience, yourself, and your material. You got to make all of those things happy in your professional gig. So, and then the other thing that I had going, so not only did I have drinks at dinner, but then bought my own drinks, but I had, as the American, I was the odd man out. And so people bought me drinks as well. So I got, shortly before I went up there, I was getting another drink and the bartender cut me off. So I had an Irish bartender.
Wait, whoa. That's bad when an Irish bartender cut you off.
I don't think they even know what it means to cut somebody off.
Wow, yeah. That's drunk.
That was drunk. That was, I think, the drunkest I ever did stand up. I did a drunk Shakespeare show in which I was ended up blackout drunk for that one. So I don't even remember the end of the show, but apparently it just ended with me going, I gotta go.
Now, what's a Shakespeare show?
There are other groups that had done a drunk Shakespeare kind of thing. For us, it was just a bunch of comedians who got drunk and then recited Shakespeare. Though for us, it was we didn't know the Shakespeare beforehand, so
excellent.
We didn't learn our lines. It was really drunk reading, you know, like readings where we were acting it out as we went. So I was playing at the time when I left, I was playing Juliet in the famous balcony scene, and me and my blonde wig just walked off, and that was the end of the scene.
Oh, that's great.
An awesome video thing for YouTube. I mean, they have drunk history. Why not drunk Shakespeare?
I'm telling you, Steve has
that's
made two
awesome
things.
Idea.
Two things tonight that would kill on YouTube. I think the
I have three YouTube channels. I'll make something work out of that.
Cool. So there definitely is a limit. Is the answer to that?
Answer yes.
And because I know that, I usually try to You know, there are some comics who feel like they need that, you know, a little something in their system.
I was one.
Like Ron White. I mean, can he even do funny without being drunk?
So, I mean, I think to a certain extent for some comics, you get to this like happy place where,
yeah,
because one of the things that, you know, your inner demons, your, and I don't mean that as like, you know, real inner voices, but, you know, your inner critic and that filter that you have, you're best when it's off. And so for some people, a drink or two helps them get into that zone. Because what I learned in stand-up, as much as I am a writer like Tony, and I'm sure Tony would say the same thing, is that you have to also be in the moment. So you have to write your material, but then be in the moment. And I think there, you know, alcohol can help you be in that moment. And, you know, for me, it's for me, I do it sometimes, but, you know, I don't feel like I need it. But I think that also came from doing all those improv comedy shows where I was, you know, stone cold sober and was able to kind of get into that zone and that mindset, which is not easy to do when you had a lousy day. You know, that's never really thought of when you're at a comedy club, that the person that's up there making you laugh may be having a horrible day.
Absolutely.
And this is their job, right? So they have to be in the moment and true to their material and make you laugh all at the same time. So like, you know, there's lots of comics that do that.
Alcohol,
with a little bit of alcohol.
Yeah, alcohol has definitely made me get in the moment many times. So
yeah.
Now you mentioned a little bit ago about your transition from improv to stand up and how you kind of lagged there at first. But I would think that, and maybe you can explain this, but to me, having done stand up, I can't imagine doing improv because that's so much a harder, I think, thing to do. I think it takes more on your feet kind of skill. Like you have to actually be thinking while performing and not just where, as sometimes stand up is, just reciting the jokes that you have in a set list. You're required to, you know, perform right there on the spot. So which one do you think is more difficult?
So I actually love them all. I love stand up. I love sketch. I love, so I forgot what I said in the order, but improv, sketch, and stand up. I love all three. I even like just, you know, writing what I think is a funny essay or something like that. Mm-hmm. Right. Or onion like articles, which I haven't done in a while, but, you know, funny is funny and I enjoy it all. You know, I started doing improv comedy, almost because it was super easy. So it's not that it doesn't take skill, but it doesn't take any preparation. You just get up and do it. And so when I was five, people would ask me what I wanted to be when I grew up, and I said, oh, I want to be a comedian. And when I said that, I was talking about being a stand-up comedian. I don't think America knew what improv comedy was at that point anyway. I kind of got into improv kind of accidentally and took classes, started performing. And like I said, for stand-up, you have to write, you have to then hone, you have to perform, and then you have to repeat that cycle until it gets great. And for improv, magic can happen just off the cuff. So the thing that is similar is that whole in the moment concept that I said, talked about a second ago.
Yeah.
When you are actually on stage and in the moment, that's when magic happens, no matter whether it's sketch, improv, or stand up. That's the key to making it fun and seem conversational and making the comedy pop. And, you know, I always, you know, I've taught improv comedy for a couple decades now, hundreds and hundreds of people. And I kind of am convinced that everybody can do improv comedy. That doesn't mean that everybody is right for the stage, but everybody can do improv. Just like we didn't have a script for this conversation that we're having. This is all improvised. The only difference between doing something on stage and the improvisation you do every day is that you're trying to run it through a different set of filters. So when you react as Kyle or you react as Steve, that's your character, obviously, in real life. But when you're doing it on stage and you're improv, you know, you would be, you know, Joe the mechanic or something like that. And you're trying to react in a way that is real, but not you. And the amazing thing about improv is that it's kind of the building the scene and building the comedy as you go that delivers the funny. And, you know, you don't necessarily need to be a stand-up comedy writer to create good scenes in improv. It just emerges out of a handful of basic skills, basic improv skills that you hone over the years.
I think that's a brilliant way to put it. I love that filter thing that you mentioned, because that actually makes sense to me, because every time I'm in a different situation, whether it be on a podcast or a hangout or some other thing, there's a filter system that goes on. You're playing to some type of audience in some way. So you are on the fly coming up with things rather than have some kind of scripted thing beforehand.
Yeah, and kind of one step beyond, which is going to make me sound crazy, but sure, why not put it out there, is that I actually refer to improv as almost like a controlled schizophrenia to a certain extent. And that is not to insult anybody that is suffering or has family members that are suffering with schizophrenia, but this is why I say that.
That's true.
Steve Lesser, and, you know, being as this is a podcast, you're going to have heard them, has those verbal tics, those uhs, those ums, that sort of thing. When I am on stage and I'm truly in character, I don't have any of those tics. So these uncontrollable tics that happen for Steve Lesser day in and day out are gone. And to me, that's kind of this bizarre second mind that I'm in when I'm up there. So I use that in my everyday life when I'm giving a talk at work or something like that during the day job. I try to get into character, essentially. That character is much like myself, but I try to deliver it as somebody else. Similarly, it's like the phenomenon where someone who stutters can actually sing, right? It's a separate space where they can perform perfectly, but they have to kind of put them in that, put their mind in that second kind of zone. And so it's a little bit crazy, but I think there's something to it.
I think putting it that way is fascinating, because it makes complete sense. Improv is what I come up with. When you have to improvise, I think that it forces your brain to kind of think in a different way. And like you said, the stutters that sing and they don't, you know, have that issue, I can completely see the similarities between that and doing stand-up. So I think that's a really cool way of putting it that I haven't thought about before.
Yeah, I do think it's like the second mind, and that is part of the exhilarating part of doing improv is you get to be the villain sometime, you get to be this different person sometime, and it's still it's for the sake of comedy, but your goal is to simply react in that other voice, which is really fun and therapeutic.
There's a whole psychology, you know, behind the stand-up too. It's just like our kind of goal, I guess you would say, with this podcast series for the season one is to kind of explore different ideas and the uniqueness that each individual brings to that idea. So, like today, we're doing stand-up, and next week we have one that I think is really interesting on food. And there was a study done where a restaurant took two plates, had the same amount of the ingredients, the same amount of spices, everything was identical. But what they did was they plated them in different styles, and they had people taste it and decide on which was better and how much they would pay for it. And based on just the plating alone, even though it was the same meal, there was a 90% like for one particular plate, and the price was about $3.50 different on the monetary scale. So basically, how you plate a dish can determine what you can charge and what are you actually paying for when you go to a restaurant? Are you actually paying, you know, for plating? So I think what you said ties into what we're trying to do with this podcast perfectly. So, I mean, that was well done.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Go ahead, Steve.
I just said, I think they should do a study with comedians, the same thing. Have a comedian get up there in a suit like Tony, and then have him do the same set in like flannel, see if there's a difference in how many people laugh. That'd be an interesting experiment.
I think that kind of happens a little bit, right? So I think you have people stealing jokes. And when someone steals a joke, so I'm actually flattered when it happens. I've had somebody steal some jokes. But it rarely comes out the same. And I think that's because it doesn't fit the rest of the persona. And I don't think that's too unlike the, you know, it's the same ingredients, right? It's the same words, or at least the same premise. And it's just being plated differently. And there's a preference for one. And that's probably because it matches the rest of, you know, the stage persona from that comic.
Certain jokes don't exist in isolation.
Although I still also think that a lot of it is delivery, and it almost doesn't matter sometimes the words you say. Certain jokes, definitely you need to, I know that that's the phrase I want to say for that punchline, and I know I have to hit it really hard and be tight, and I can't screw up those words. I can change the words of the setup and I can play with that, but the punchline is set. But even with that, I'm kind of convinced that there's times where the words themselves don't matter, and that what the audience is reacting to is my cue that, hey, it's time to laugh. And so I've always wanted to do this experiment where I translate one of my sets that always works well into a different language that I don't understand, and then deliver it confidently and well practiced in that other language, just to see, do they laugh at the right places still? So I'm
where do you get all these great ideas from?
Well, I don't know. I'm not sure that's a great idea, but it would make a great YouTube. Like just having both the joke in English and then translated, and you can hear the reaction and see if they laugh.
It's almost like I'll use example of George Carlin to what you were saying. I don't think that anybody alive today could do Carlin word for word and it come out anywhere as funny as he could deliver it. You know, he just had that cadence that he had, and you know, he was very methodical about it. I mean, there was a psychology back to that behind his. But I think if you were to take his jokes and have somebody memorize them and put them on stage, no one could come close to
without doing an impersonation of George Carlin,
right, and so
I think there's a reason you don't see, like, you know, the equivalent of a cover band, you know, somebody doing like, hey, I'm gonna cover George Carlin tonight.
That's another good idea.
Yeah, I'm gonna look for something to do. Sam Kennison, that'd be an awesome cover.
Yeah, and so like you can do like a show, kind of like a Goodnights did a show in Raleigh that, you know, people kind of impersonated their you know, kind of a classic comedian, and then either performed in their style or actually delivered those jokes. But it's either an impersonation, but it's really hard to take George Carlin material and then, like, you know, pawn it off as your own. First of all, because that's well known, but second of all, that's not your voice. That was written in his voice and magically so.
He was a legend.
He was the full package.
Legend. I actually have seen him in concert more often than any other, like, and I'm glad I saw it. But at the time, I was like, we drove 7.5 hours for this show. That was, you know, a little unfortunate. But I had already seen him at least 3 times live, and knew he was you know, knew. Actually, at that time, I think that may have been the second time that I saw him live. And like, honestly, the more intimate the place for Carlin, the best. Like, I saw him in Albany, New York, and he did a show in the Round. And the stage, I'm probably misremembering it, but I think the stage was like maybe like 15 feet in diameter. So it's not a huge stage, and he was just surrounded by a few hundred people. So everybody was close to him, and he just kept on rotating like he was on a record and delivering this. But you could for Carlin, his face was such an important part of his comedy. That's why I thought his HBO specials always worked really great.
Oh, yeah.
They'd get a close up of his face. So when he had that reaction to what the end of an egg was, you could see it in his face, which was just amazing.
He got on a soapbox and he was talking about how Americans treated each other. Could that have been the beginning of what he eventually became famous for? Because that's kind of what he did, but in a funny way. The faults and how we are to each other and how the government is lies about this and about that and religion. Could that be the kind of turning point for him?
Well, he may have actually, it may have been a turning point, but not the turning point, because, yeah, you know, he always had elements of that as far back as I can remember, you know, outside of like the hippy dippy weatherman, where it was just kind of like a character. And, you know, when he really found his voice, it had that satire on society kind of built into it, not on everything, because like he had some of my favorite bits about have a nice day, that is only like a mild satire on America. It's really just saying like people just say this stuff, they don't mean it. So even some of those sorts of things, even by the time I got into him, like he was ending every show on the seven words you can't say. And that definitely was talking about very much about society. So I think what happened, and maybe that was the beginning of that kind of inflection point for him, is that he started to kind of change a little bit more about, I never thought of him as an angry comic. But then you see some things following that. There's some real anger and behind the words that he's saying.
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
And yet it's still funny.
I think, interesting side note, I remember, I can't remember if it was, it may have been during the UCC actually, but I remember actually being at the Idiot Box when he did a tribute to George Carlin and put up his seven words that you can't say on television on that projector screen that was like by the left side of the stage.
Yeah. I think that was when he passed away, I think we did that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And honestly, we don't do tributes to all the comics, but for that, I mean, he'll never know what he did for me. I grew up on, my first comedy album was Steve Martin. Then after that, it was Bob Newhart. I had his album. And then after that, it was all George Carlin stuff. But not all George Carlin stuff, but a lot of George Carlin. And so, I grew up just with such an admiration for all those guys. Stephen Wright was another one that I had early on a tape of that I played so much I wore out.
Did you like Bill Hicks?
Yeah. There's hardly a comic that I don't like. There's a couple comics where I feel like they are less creative because they depend on Dunham, for example. Not a huge fan of racist puppetry, but
Dane Cook.
So Dane Cook, I definitely admire Dane Cook. So I know that he got vilified by a lot of the comedians, mm-hmm. but the thing that I admired about Dane was his ability to perform. Even you'll hear a bit of his on Sirius XM still, and it's just, he just squeezed the marrow out of every bit, and you could kind of feel that energy. And I never saw him live. I don't think I've even seen much. I've probably heard him more than I've seen him, even videos. And that energy comes through. He has a really great stage presence, and that I think is very admirable.
I feel like he's he gets the rap like the Nickelback does in the rock world. You know, for some reason. Everyone just seems to not like Dane Cook anymore.
Yeah, I mean, I think when you steal other people's material, and that's the real unfortunate thing. I mean, he was in a place where that was not necessary, but it's not just him that has been caught doing that. It even came up again for Amy Schumer, and I think every now and then it comes up. And there's definitely parallel thinking that happens, but there's also definitely a culture that even if it comes out worse, every comedian feels like their jokes are their own intellectual property, and it's just not protected in the same way that other, you can't write a cease and desist, don't tell this joke anymore. Dane Cook is one of the examples where it contradicts what I said before. Like, I've had amateurs steal my jokes and they come out really poorly. Like I said, I'm flattered that they thought it was funny enough that they wanted to steal it. But I never had Dane Cook steal my joke, right? And it probably doesn't feel good to see your joke performed in front of like 20,000 people far right. more successfully than I could ever do. I get it. But he was certainly a funny dude and had his strengths as an amazing performer.
Speaking of somebody else who didn't who was in a good place comedy wise and didn't have to resort to stealing jokes, do you remember Carlos Mencia and when Joe Rogan?
Absolutely.
That was I'm a huge fan of Joe Rogan anyway. He's one of my heroes. But I think that was probably the turning point where I was like, yep, Joe Rogan is that's the man. Because when he walked up on stage and took Carlos was stealing from Bill Cosby.
It was downright shocking, I think, too. Right. So, and the shameless stealing, because he was like, yeah. And like, I can get that side of it too. Like, I understand it. I guess it's the difference between like an understanding / compassion and a sympathy. Right. So sure. I'm not trying to defend it by any means, but I understand where someone who is creative can say, I took a nugget of something and I made it my own. The place where I don't think it's the reason that I think for Carlos Mencia that it was crossing the line was that in a bunch of places it was word for word, and that's not taking that's not parallel thinking around a premise. That's not taking a premise and doing something different with it. I am a firm believer that there can be a million comedians doing their own take on dating as a premise, so like you can reuse a premise, a comic can't own a premise, but the thing that makes the funny thing in there, when you're taking so much of it, that's where I think you cross the line. And it was unfortunate because again, someone who didn't need that. And also, the folks that have been called out, they can afford writers, right? You can get, and I think in the case of Amy Schumer, I think it was some of her writers that got that. Like, so some of their sketches were lifted from other, other groups. And those I think were pretty blatant ripoffs, but it wasn't her, and she wouldn't have known, I don't think, an individual can't have seen every, bit of comedy to know what's been done or not. And I think there's a lot of pressure to write for those shows. So like, I get where that would happen. Not to excuse it, but I understand where that would get, come out.
Well, since you own a club, have you had that happen? Has there ever been an instance where you've caught someone blatantly stealing someone else's material?
We've had that happen. We've had actually people make it to like through the first round of the UCC, and I remember there was one I'll call him a kid because he was on the young side, but he was 20 something. So a young comic come through, and I was like, wow, he's, you know, for a young comic, he's really good. And someone's like, oh yeah, that's because it's not his material. And then I looked it up on YouTube and I watched the actual comedian do it. And so, for him, I told him, we used to have like a lot of paperwork for the UCC around, you got to do your own material. It's got to be your own original material. And, you know, at the time he had signed that. So I was like, you know, that's not cool. So do your own stuff or don't do the competition, especially around the competition. That's completely unfair to be an audience pleaser and writing your own stuff is very different than, you know, covering somebody else's material. And so, I have had to have some talks with some open micers to say, you know, being a stand-up is far more about the writing than it is about the performance. You know, so the number of people who think that that open mics are about, you know, retelling a street joke that you saw on an email or retelling a joke that you saw on the latest Netflix special, you know, that's actually not an insignificant percent of people who come to the club thinking that that's what stand-up is about. And, you know, we usually try to do it in a non-confrontational way to explain to them that that's not what it's about, that stand-up is actually a lot of work. You write the jokes down, there's a process that you follow, and there's both an art and a skill to it at the same time. And usually people get that.
Yeah.
I think that's easier to get across than, I think the thing that some people, young comics in particular, that struggle with is, on edginess, because their idols are edgy. So they're like, well, I want to be edgy. And I don't disagree with that, but I do disagree with, you know, that shouldn't be your first open mic, because when you try to do edgy at your first open mic, it's racist or misogynist or offensive in some way. It's not edgy. It's both edgy and offensive.
Right.
Right. It takes a real skill to be edgy and funny. And Gerard Carmichael came through the club. He actually, you know, grew up in Winston-Salem, and he did just a drop-in. And at the time, I didn't know who the heck he was. And I've always said it to, you know, as I was coaching people in comedy, to try to be, if you're going to do something that's a little edgy in your stuff, don't have that be the first thing out of your face. You know, when you get up there and you just, that's the thing that comes out of your face first. Like you're, you know, the audience doesn't know you yet. They don't know your stage persona, and they don't know if what you're saying is real or if you're just saying that to satire, you know, to satire, right. You know, hate.
Not everybody can be Don Rickles, right?
Yeah. Well, and so the first time you see Don Rickles, you already know Don Rickles' character, right? And same thing for most of the famous comedians. Louis C.K. did a, you know, bit where he starts talking about how everybody in the audience is going to die, but everybody knows the character, so it's not depressing because everybody knows the stage persona.
Yeah.
So Gerard Carmichael was the only comic that I had no idea who he was, and the things that he was saying. You just instantly knew that he meant it to be funny and it was okay to laugh, even though what he was saying, if it came out of anybody else's face, you'd be like, ooh, and you would cringe. But for him, he had that gift, and he just made it funny instantly. So the very first thing out of his face was something that, you know, I think 99 out of 100 times would be offensive, and it came across as just, I can't remember what it was. I just remember just my jaw hit the ground from being floored about how he was able to successfully do that. I often will kind of talk about like Lisa Lampanelli. Right. And so rough stuff that she's going through. But if you go to a Lisa Lampanelli show, you already know what you're in
she's
for.
She's brutal.
brutal. But even then, she eases into it in a way that there's like some comedy foreplay that she's doing, which is very masterful, right? So she starts to the jokes with jokes coming out of a place of love and admiration, and then the things get rougher and rougher as it goes. But you at that point, it's more like a roast and speaking to society versus, you know, actually meaning those things, right? And that's why, you know, some roasts work and some don't.
Everybody says, well, now that Trump's president, the jokes will literally write themselves. So do you try to talk about that, or do you stay away from the whole political aspect of it?
So, you know, it kind of goes back to I don't want to put off the crowd. And you know, we live in a red state. And, you know, it's not my particular brand of politics. But, you know, for the most part, I stay away from what I call those third rail topics. And so, you know, I have some jokes that, you know, are at the expense of, you know, Fox News and that sort of thing.
Of course.
But
gotta have those.
But, you know, with Trump, you know, to a certain extent, and I've heard other comics say that it's coming, like the material is coming at such a fast and furious kind of like nothing stands out because there's so much of it.
That's such a good point.
And so it's tough to kind of pick on that one thing because it's only in a news cycle because there's a new thing that hits the next news cycle. So that there's nothing that ends up being all that memorable. But at the same time, when there's something that big, I felt almost obligated to write something about it. And for a while, I was doing a Trump impersonation up there, and I don't do impersonations, but I was talking about you know, that what I felt was like the silver lining of the election. And that was something that just came true. Actually, was I was like, the silver lining to Trump getting elected is that he's going to be up there at the Hall of Presidents at Disney World, and so that I just did an impersonation of things that he would have said or things that he did say, and the context of that coming out of a animatronic machine at Disney World is both horrific and funny at the same time.
Did you see how horrific the actual thing was?
the look of it kind of looks like maybe somebody from a blue state made that thing.
I was gonna say, you don't do it on purpose. I mean, you have to know that was intentional, because everybody else looks, you know, just like you see portraits of them, and then you have
his doesn't look like him. It just doesn't.
maybe it did, and they left it out in the summer sun or something like that. It was in the car too long and just melted a little. I don't know.
A bag of crushed up Cheetos. That's exactly what it looks like.
It does. Yeah. So like he's a tough one to make fun of. And then, I mean, the other thing is that, I definitely don't want to offend anybody. And somebody that, you know, there's enough political discourse out there that's painful. And, you know, I try to be more of a distraction for that. So that's mostly why I stay away from those kind of topics, is that I can speak to society and, you know, make fun of myself for the lack of critical thinking without having to talk about the painful stuff that goes on Facebook. It's the same message, but it's not as in your face. And, you know, I'm not trying to preach to people too, because I find that not funny in general if I feel like someone's preaching to me. But if someone walks away going, yeah, I do that too, you're right, I don't think about stuff and maybe I should, that's a cool side effect. But that's certainly not my primary intention when I'm getting up on stage.
Let's say that there's somebody listening who is thinking about doing or getting into stand-up or improv. They just can't make up their mind. What advice would you give? It's unique with you because performance not only with stand-up and improv and sketch, but you actually book acts and you know what it's like to be a stand-up comedian. So you're kind of like this perfect person to ask this question.
do it. If you have the thought that it's something that you want to do, it doesn't get easier tomorrow. It doesn't get easier in 3 years. There's always going to be some barrier to doing it, whether it's your nerves or you got to break away from the family to do it, or day job, whatever. It doesn't get any easier. So my only regret about stand-up is that I didn't start earlier. I told you I was 5 when I wanted to be a stand-up comedian. When I was in grad school, I started improv. But when I was in college, I actually had a notebook full of my set, and I thought I went to an open mic with the intention of delivering my first set, and I chickened out and didn't go. Actually, I found out that time that you needed to sign up ahead of time, and then I was like, all right, well, I can't go tonight, so I had the out, but I never went back. I chickened out and never went back, even though it's one of my bigger regrets of not doing it. So anybody that's interested in it just needs to find an open mic and try it. And there are open mics and there are open mics. If you're in the triangle, the Good Nights is a great one. If you're in the triad, the Idiot Box has a very welcoming open mic. Go to it, see what it's about, and then the next week, go with the intention of performing. Pay attention that first week when you're just there observing, seeing how long the sets are, where the light comes from, how do they get introduced, how do you get on the list. Take those sorts of unknowns out of it, so that when you go up, you have a little bit more confidence. If you're an extrovert and you want to bring a bunch of friends because that makes it easier because it's going to be more fun, do it. If you're an introvert, don't tell a soul that you're going and just show up and do that. But I think you'll find that in every comedy scene, there's people there that want to support you, and find those people and find out how to get better. You can also take classes if you feel like you need a little bit of, something extra before you get up there. And we do this at the Idiot Box, of course. We teach improv, we teach sketch, we teach stand-up classes. And it's not that you need the classes. Certainly Carlin didn't get to the level he is because he took a class in comedy. But what you get in the class is you get better faster, right? So you can get better over time, or you can take a class and short circuit it. So you can get some feedback and some input that will help you get better faster. So
where would they go to find those? I'm sorry, those classes. Where would they look up your class schedule and sign up for those?
Yeah, so those will be again, social media, following us on social media, but also on our website, ibxcomedy.com, or, again, if you're in Raleigh in the triad, triangle rather, Good Nights. I actually also teach there. But it's not unique to North Carolina. You'll find wherever you're listening to this podcast, if you look up stand-up comedy class or you look up improv comedy class, you will find something in your neck of the woods. And I'm certain there's going to be, clubs that don't have, they don't have it, or they don't have a decent one. But, I think for the most part, there's such a... comedians generally have such a passion for comedy that they want to make sure that other people that have that passion also can find a way to get up on stage. And that's such an important thing. If you're really supporting the community, it's such an important give back, because that only builds the scene, not only for a particular area, but just comedy in general.
Oh, yeah. So... give us the details about the Ultimate Comic Challenge one more time, and then about the festival.
Sure. So the Ultimate Comic Challenge, January 20th at 8:30 at the Carolina Theater in Greensboro. That's downtown Greensboro. And you can get the tickets at carolinatheater.com. You can buy them online or at the box office. You can even buy them over the phone. And I think if you're at the box office or over the phone, there's not a fee. But if you do it online through their ticketing system, there's a small fee that gets added. But you can, like I said, get them at the door the night of on Saturday the 20th. And then the festival is February 19th through the 24th. The headliners, Sasheer Zamata, Eddie Pepitone, Todd Glass, Ms. Pat, Mo Alexander, Eddie Brill, and then also stand-up and sketch headliners as well. You can find out about those shows on nccomedyfestival.com and with links to all of the shows. And I think that probably covers it. If you go to the website, you'll find out more than my babbling about the schedule, because there's 250 comics spread across, you know, over 50 shows. There's some nights where we have four venues going at the same time. So we definitely need the support of the community to come out, because otherwise, you know, we could be doing this alone, right? We don't. the festival, honestly, it's a lot of work and a huge expense. If the people don't come out to support, you know, we'll be one and done in the triad, and certainly not what we're aiming to do.
I don't think that's going to be the case for you guys.
I don't think so either. I think everybody that hears about it is excited about it. So I think even if you don't go to it and you're listening to this from and you're in transit in New York City or California, you probably know somebody in the area, and spreading the word on social media helps. So
absolutely,
we appreciate it.
I appreciate you coming on to talk about it. That was really cool. Great conversation.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us, Steve. That was awesome. That was really, really good. Entertaining. I enjoyed that.